It's Monday, October 9th, 2006. This is Mike Rupert, live from Caracas, Venezuela. It's about 2:10 in the afternoon, and I am doing this now. We're starting a new service at the FTW website, which will be biweekly, that we will be sending from Venezuela live to the FTW site for upload for our subscribers. And I'm painfully aware and very much aware of all of the emails that have been sent, all the phone calls that have been made to our office asking for more information about my status, how I'm doing, and everything else. But the best thing that I can do for you is to do what I have always done for you, which is to start by giving you the details and the information and the updates on world events that you want. We'll have plenty of time in this to talk about me later on. Right now, the world is in a great state of flux. There are major events taking place. And what you've always wanted from me first was my analysis of those events, so let's get right down to business with that. If you've been following the website closely in the last 2 weeks, you've noticed a couple of key pieces that I've written, one of which was an analysis of the UN event where Hugo Chavez and Ahmadinejad were kind of the stars there because of their theatrics and performances. Not to put them down, but I said in my analysis piece about 10 days old, 2 weeks old, that North Korea was the real star, and we saw the evidence of that today with North Korea's report of a successful underground nuclear test which has rocked the world. And in my analysis, I said very clearly that North Korea was part of many nations that are challenging U.S. hegemony and power around the world, and that the U.S. was being revealed systematically, piece by piece, to be something of a paper tiger from a military and from a political standpoint around the world. Today's test was a direct slap in the face to the Bush administration, following just days after Assistant Secretary of State Christopher Trujillo had said that North Korea doesn't have a future if it tests a nuclear device. And just days later, the announcement came. And I need to point out that several news stories reported that there were confirmations of, quote, artificial earthquakes measuring, I think, in the mid-3 range, 3 to 4 range on the Richter scale, which would tend to corroborate the fact that, yes, indeed, there was an underground nuclear explosion. So the world is getting drastically dangerous. But we see also today sharp rises quote, due to uncertainty in commodity prices. The oil prices, again, on the rise. Now, if you take North Korea out of the picture, the fact that we've seen this rapid 20-25% decline from the $77 high down to below 60, now it's starting to bounce back rapidly. This is exactly 100% in conformity with what I and Michael Caine wrote about in our recent analysis of the effect of oil price drops and moving into this rapid period of instability and rapid price spikes and the rapid falls that are going to mark what we call the bumpy plateau of peak oil. We have no idea how long this plateau is going to last because it's going to be marked by massive instability in the markets. And we're going to see the gold prices roughly follow oil prices up and down. With that instability, you're going to see lots and lots of small traders just blasted out of the markets. Only the big guys are going to be able to save these massive up and down spikes. I think clearly we're at a peak of what's called a pump and dump phase for the Dow. And I think that certainly within a month, we'll see oil prices back above 65, if not back at 70 again, based upon world events. So this is all on the map. This is on the map we have drawn for you for 8.5 years at From the Wilderness. It's on the map that I drew for you in Crossing the Rubicon with so many great people who helped write that book. The Mike Caines and the great researchers like the Michelle Chelsidovskis and all the people who helped make Rubicon possible, and our dear friend Catherine Austin Fitz. Something else that I noticed today was out of the UN piece that was up last week, I said, hey guys, you know, we've been saying for 3 years now that the United States is not going to attack Iran, and I had a big piece about 6 months ago called Rapprochement, where I said very clearly that my tea leaves and the map I was reading said that the U.S. and Iran were going to normalize relations probably fairly soon after George Bush leaves office. The primary reason for that is the need to get Caspian oil, this heavy, sour, very expensive oil, which is very expensive to produce, let alone transport, to Western markets. the Bush administration's plans around 9/11, before, during, and shortly thereafter, were to build pipelines either across Afghanistan and Pakistan to the Indian Ocean, or to in some other way bypass Russia. Of course, due to the failed U.S. Military efforts in the region, the lack of stability, those pipelines are impossible. Iran has an existing pipeline system that's in very good shape, and Iran happens to border the Caspian Sea. So all that's necessary is to plug Caspian oil directly into Iran's pipelines, and you can have it immediately shipped to the Persian Gulf and through the Straits of Hormuz. Today, coincidentally or not, Iran Mania, an Iranian news website, said just exactly the same thing in a story that we should be putting up on the website in our key stories from around the world section. So what are we looking at here around the world? Well, we're looking at massive instability. We're looking at a time of great crisis. And I stand by my earlier analysis that the so-called massive, bigger attacks, the 9/11 British airline hoax of July, was just that. It was an artificially manufactured move to destroy demand at a time when demand was vastly outstripping supply, and to reduce prices, which led to the price reduction. And now, as we're just on the cusp soon enough of the winter heating season, we conveniently have a North Korean test. And I have to ask myself the question, I'm not drawing any conclusions from this, but I have to ask myself the question, isn't it interesting how all these events, these world events, seem to coincide with the price spikes? And my question is, gee, would these price spikes and dips be occurring without these events? Are they not just looking for something to explain or justify to keep people away from focusing on the true issue of peak oil that were there? If, in fact, we do see massive price spikes again, going back up over $70 a barrel before the end of the year, then we've pretty much confirmed that peak oil is real, because nothing else is going to explain these kinds of price spikes, which never in the history of oil prices have we seen before. We saw one huge spike in 73, 74 with the first OPEC embargo, but that was one blip. When we start seeing these alligator teeth very tightly compressed over time, then you can be certain that we are just about to go down the cliff. And in the story that Mike Kane and I wrote, we started off with this brilliant graph, a chart drawn by Richard Duncan, who was one of the pioneers in the peak oil movement, that was published about a year ago now, which he sent to me after he had done it, which pretty much describes it. That chart talked about energy production or oil production per capita, but it shows the same thing whether you're graphing price or oil production as a whole. We're there. So what can we expect in the near future? Well, I think the U.S. has been directly challenged. This is like a point in a bar fight, or just before a bar fight, when there's no more wiggle room. The U.S. has drawn its tough line in the sand. It now has to do something globally to embarrass North Korea. Now, the only thing left for the U.S. to do, the only things left that I'm aware of, are pretty stupid. It has no real military option short of a nuclear attack, which would be, of course, the end of civilization as we know it. China, Japan, South Korea would not stand for that. South Korea would probably be taken out in a heartbeat. And I strongly suspect that even though China is making a lot of political statements saying that, a press statement saying that, gee, what North Korea did was terrible, I think behind the scenes the Chinese are laughing their fannies off, saying, oh, good job. That remains to be seen. We are watching at the same time, though, and this is something that we all need to watch, is if there is any increase in guerrilla, insurgent, whatever they call it, activity in Iran and Afghanistan. Of course, Iran, as we have said for a long time, is now a bloodbath. The carnage there goes on daily and increases. U.S. forces are stressed to beyond belief. U.S. casualties are up, and the so-called civil war that we have said that the U.S. has wanted from day one is clearly underway, because what the U.S. wants to do is partition Iraq to control the oil and discard the pieces that it doesn't need to protect. But we need to watch what kind of play is given around the world as a result of perceived U.S. weakness vis-a-vis North Korea. Hugo Chavez, I think, is, as I have said and as I have written, I think clearly understands the world as it is. That the U.S. empire is in collapse, or it is beginning to collapse. It is beginning to implode. What will replace or fill that vacuum as the U.S. empire contracts will not be one power. It will be many powers. And the non-aligned nations of the world, particularly nations like China, India, Iran, North Korea, Venezuela, are key players recognizing that that void is going to have to be filled, because if it's not filled, of course, then chaos will be the most likely result and everybody loses. So these are very interesting times, which brings me, of course, now talking about Hugo Chavez and Venezuela to where I am now in Caracas and where I have been since leaving the United States forever on July 19th, now almost 3 months ago. I did not have the luxury, due to the circumstances of my departure and the fear for my safety, which I have to honestly say was just as well mixed with this incredible heartsick awareness that I could no longer live in the country that the United States has become. It was clear that anything that I did there with my personal life, my work life, with From the Wilderness was going to be sabotaged or damaged, as we've documented it has been for several years now. But, you know, I was also at a place, at a moment of conscious choice, saying I cannot stay in this country. I have to stop living in the problem and start living in the solution. I left the United States with one large suitcase, a backpack, and my laptop, a laptop case, and I've been here since. And I would love to say that Caracas has been a total picnic, that I'm getting on fine, but that's not true. Anytime one leaves one's native country for a new culture, for a new language, it's a shock. And under the circumstances that I did, it has been a shock for me. I'm learning Spanish, lo estudio cada día, here. I am making friends. I have been warmly received by some wonderful people like Ava Golinger, a Venezuelan U.S. attorney who wrote a brilliant book, The Chavez Code. Greg Wilpert of Venezuela Analysis, and I have two great friends here with me as I'm recording today, who I've made, Ivan Gil, who is a Venezolano native, who is a trader who just recently leaving his job at J.P. Morgan Chase, but has been a tremendous asset to me, and Carlos Ruiz, a brilliant young British guy who came to my rescue. He was an FTW subscriber. And with whom I'm living now at some place in Caracas. I have had a couple of negative experiences here that we might or might not conclude. You can't jump to conclusions. We're connected to the U.S. government. But I, on the whole, I'm seeing a lot that's different. And I know that many FTW subscribers have emailed me and said, you know, we're thinking about leaving the country and going here and going there. And I started asking off by asking them questions. Well, do you speak the language where you're going? Do you have friends there? Are you familiar with the culture? And I have to tell you that those are very important questions. And for those FTW subscribers who are considering emigrating, as I know many of you are, either now or at some other point, if the economy collapses or the police state repression becomes worse, I encourage you to do a lot of research first. I encourage you to try to get used to the water as much as possible. Caracas is a beautiful city. It's tropical. It's hot. I have to get used to the humidity. These are all challenges for a white guy like me. I notice that people here laugh more. I notice that there's a lot more courtesy, but Caracas is a big city like any other big city. My status here is that I have requested permanent residency status. I have made official contacts at the government, and there are some things in the works that we're still waiting for resolution on. And I have to be honest to tell you, I don't know if it will be viable for me to stay in Caracas. I hope so, because I totally agree with the rationale and the stated objectives of the Bolivarian Revolution, which are basically as follows. That local resources should be kept locally, for the use of people in the region where the resources are. That is the heart of what we have talked about in relocalization. From the FTW website and from the brilliant DVD by Megan Quinn and Pat Murphy from the Power of Community about Cuba. That's what people like Richard Heinberg and Julian Darley talk about. This is a socialist country. I know that's a bad, it's a knee-jerk word for most Americans, but the right of private property ownership is enshrined in the Bolivarian Constitution. What the socialism here says is that the major public assets, the joint community assets, should be owned and managed by the state for the benefit of the people rather than for shareholders. Hear, hear, that's what FTW has been saying for a long time. There are a lot of wonderful things that are being done, but of course you know there is coming in Venezuela a presidential election December 3rd, and we're waiting to see what new tricks the CIA will pull this time. For those of you who don't know, again, Ava Golinger's book, The Chavez Code, documents this brilliantly using Freedom of Information Act requests or documents obtained thereunder to show direct CIA, National Endowment for Democracy, U.S. State Department, military inspiration, leadership, and financing of the coup in 2002 in which many Venezuelan citizens were shot April 11th, 2002. By the opposition, and that was they attempted to blame that on Chavez. We saw that in her book that CNN had recorded a meeting of military officers the night before the shooting talking about the shooting, which is proof of premeditation in those murders. We have no idea what kind of tricks are going to be played. It's clear that Chavez is on the U.S. administration's, if you will, list of enemies, but so is North Korea. So sort of is Iran. So are the insurgents in Iraq, and the U.S. is not doing well with any of those. Here, the mood is generally very confident. There's been a great deal of talk about a large march this last weekend, which I saw, of about, some say, 150,000 people for the opposition candidate Manuel Rosales. But the general consensus here is that Chavez is going to win this election, hands down, and It's clear here that when Chavez needs to, he can put a quarter of a million people in the street in a heartbeat. There doesn't seem to be a lot of concern. If I were advising the Venezuelan government, I would say don't get cocky and don't get complacent because you never know what tricks might be coming. It's clear that the CIA has recently upped the stakes here. They have assigned a new special mission with a program manager named Maher, I believe, M-A-H-E-R, specifically focusing on Cuba and Venezuela. So clearly the stakes are high. And one of the reasons why the stakes are high is because you may have caught this recently in an interview. Matthew Simmons, the world's largest energy investment banker, said that he thought very clearly, it was becoming clear that perhaps the planet did pass peak last year, last December, last November, which would put him on the same page with Kenneth DeFays of Princeton, who said peak was Thanksgiving of last year. When you got a guy like Matthew Simmons saying that, that's really saying something, which would confirm that Saudi Arabia's past peak. And again, Saudi Arabia is massively buying up every offshore oil rig in the world. And why would they need to drill for oil with offshore oil rigs that cost $100, $200 million at all that cost if they had plenty of oil onshore? So what that means is about the Orinoco heavy oil belt, which is very much like the Canadian tar sands, except for it's a lot deeper, and they have to drill four wells around one well and inject steam down the four wells to drive the heavy oil up. Very labor intensive. And if you use the model of Canadian tar sands, what you see is that Canada, after, 10 years of development and I think it's about $20 billion, a lot of investment, they're able to produce a million barrels a day from this horribly destructive process in Canada. And they're projecting that in another 10 years, with maybe another $20, $25, $30 billion in investment, they might get up to 3 million barrels a day. Well, the U.S. alone is consuming 22 million barrels a day. And this was, of course, the great error of Greg Palast in his recent book and in his articles that Richard Heinberg so beautifully refuted by saying that the trillion barrels that may exist in Orinoco is going to allow the world to continue merrily on its callously consuming path. That ain't going to happen. What is so significant, though, is that we see that Venezuela, in 10 years, maybe sooner, maybe the big dog on the planet in terms of oil supply. Saudi Arabia has pushed to the brink with secondary, tertiary recovery. They're destroying, they're risking the collapse of their fields, like we have seen with Bergen in Kuwait last year. And with all of that, Venezuela may wind up with the biggest reserves left on the planet, but what happens when tomorrow's big dog is 40% of the size of yesterday's big dog? Clearly, Orinoco's oil, while it will be sold on the world markets, most of it's going to need to stay in Latin America for the future survival of Latin American civilization. That's one of the reasons why I'm happy to be here. So before I wind this up, this is our first of these, and we're going to get two a week out to you. And boy, do we need the money. So if you like this service, please tell others. The FTW website has been suffering, and I'm not running the business anymore. I'm out of the country. And so there are fairly new hands. If you hear that, that's some fireworks in the background. If you have been following FTW and like us, we need sales now and we need some cash. Our writers, our wonderful writers, Carolyn Baker, Michael Caine, Stan Goff, Jamie Heck will be back with us someday, and our wonderful office staff have really been living on fumes, as have I. It's a very difficult time. I have signed over day-to-day administration. Power of attorney has been given to a lawyer in Ashland, Oregon, and to my agent publicist, Ken Levine, in Los Angeles, of More Than News production. Ken's been with us now for 6 years. And I'm out of control, and I'm of the company, and I'm living on fumes here. But the FTW site needs all the support you can get. Now, I'm still alive. You're hearing my voice, and I'm touched by the messages on our blog, which you can access from the homepage on the Michael Rupert blog or the FTW blogspot, and the messages that have been received through FTW expressing concern, your affection, your support, your loyalty, and these have brought me to tears on many occasions since I've left the country. This is a difficult time, but so what? It's a difficult time for many people around the world, and we have to be prepared for that. Like I warned in the last recorded message I did in the States, which is now on our DVD, Fear and Present Danger. So we need your support, and I promise that I'm going to be here giving you my analysis twice a week, and I'm going to be sending these up for our subscribers. And we ask now that you do whatever you can to send money and donations into our website to renew. I know that while they were making the changes to the website that I don't know about, or I'm not in control of, the subscription pages all became free for a long time, which drastically cut into our income. But if you want to keep me going, if you want to keep FTW going, here it is, here I am. I have not left you. You can hear my voice, and I'll be with you as long as there's breath in my body. And I love you, and I love FTW, and thanks to all of you who have been with us for so long and through so much. This is Mike Rupert in Caracas, Venezuela. Hasta luego.